Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, January 14th. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. The governor plans how best to crack down on fireworks scoff laws in light of a mass casualty event following a New Year's Eve explosion. Steeper fines and longer jail terms are on the table as lawmakers start off the new legislative session. And got old pairs of prescription eyeglasses or hearing aids just sitting around your house? The Lions Club is looking for donations to help others hear and see. A new project looks at the bacteria affecting women's health and is looking to sign up participants. And a film highlighting a problem with forced marriages for young girls in Pakistan. We also step into a breadfruit agroforest and ponder the many types of ulu. Out of a garden, Ulutopia is born. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The deadly New Year's Eve explosion that killed four people and injured dozens weighs heavy on our community. Governor Josh Green held a news conference yesterday. He laid out his administration's plans to address illegal fireworks following the mass casualties that our first responders and hospitals had to deal with. According to Green, the blast resulted in more burn patients to care for than those from the Maui wildfires. Here's Green on what legislative actions he is proposing.
We are proposing significant enhancements in the penalties so that we can literally enhance sentencing to Class B and A felonies if people are killed when these fireworks go off, even accidentally. It has to stop. We'll do anything that we can. Any ideas that people come up with, we'd be happy to entertain. We believe that if we have more public fireworks shows and include society more, maybe it will damp it down a little bit. But we've also heard from people saying in just the day after we lost loved ones, that they still intended to have big fireworks shows in their communities. And I just tell you, I don't think you should do it. I really don't think you should do it because it will not be safe. So we're going to better define what a firework is, make it simpler so that we can actually prosecute individuals that make the wrong decision to have these enormous explosions going off on our streets. We did already take some action. We have our sheriff's team here, Department of Law Enforcement. They've already done an amnesty event, which was very good. It collected 1,374.2 pounds of illegal fireworks right away. So we're going to keep collecting fireworks. We're going to collect guns. We're going to do what we can. But even that is going to be a small fraction of what is historically going off in the sky on 4th of July and on New Year's especially.
You know, and HPR also asked about the challenges associated with prosecuting crimes involving possession and distribution of illegal fireworks. Here's what Attorney General Ann Lopez had to say.
There are a few very basic problems with the existing law, and that is the definitions of fireworks and aerial devices. Right now, those definitions require expert witnesses and forensic evidence to establish that somebody actually used an aerial device or a firework. We're changing those definitions so that we don't require expert witness or forensic evidence. The other thing that we don't have at this point is any kind of infraction for having small offenses. We've only had offenses that were, for certain pounds of fireworks and so forth. So by providing sort of these low-level offenses, we'll have a better opportunity to keep fireworks off of the street with just anybody. The second thing is, in addition to the definitions, determining how many pounds somebody had becomes an issue. And so this bill will streamline some of that so that instead of increments based on 25 pounds or less or 25 pounds to 50 pounds, we're getting rid of most of those increments and having a separation of 25 pounds and up or 25 pounds and below.
You know, we have also been hearing from our listeners since our two live call-in shows last week that featured first responders and law enforcement officials. We got this letter from Jay, who writes, "I know fireworks are popular, but so are speeding and other reckless behaviors. That's why we have speed limits and require seatbelts, because people don't have the maturity to protect themselves and the people around them. How about repeatedly announcing, starting 2 weeks before New Year's Eve, that you're going to arrest people for illegal use of fireworks, and then sending a few police cars around all the neighborhoods, making very public examples of the people they catch? How many more people and pets have to suffer and die year after year from our officials' acceptance of anarchy?" An anonymous caller left us this voicemail.
"Governor Green, do not spend my tax money on fireworks. 1 year, there was 3 professional fireworks shows you could see over the ocean at Ala Moana, Waikiki, and Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. Something is wrong with the brain wiring of these scofflaws who shoot off explosives. It is like a porn addiction where their brain wiring has been changed. And to view fireworks from afar one night is not enough. These scofflaws have to blow up explosives every day and night for a month before the holiday, a month after, and every 10 minutes on the holiday. That is not correct behavior. Something is wrong with their brain wiring."
And we got this email from Katie. "I want to give my opinion on illegal fireworks. I live just below the Tantalus Lookout in Manoa. 3 to 5 nights a week, we get illegal fireworks being set off above our homes, and it looks like a bomb going off. I've told my representatives. I have talked to the police. They told me to call 911 every time it happens. I think I called 20 times in December for my mental and physical health and to ensure our homes don't burn down. Please stop illegal fireworks. I'm at my wit's end. Many of my neighbors are elderly, and someone is going to have a heart attack one night. The only positive outcome from the horrific events from New Year's Eve is that it has been quiet for the first 10 days of 2025. And we also got this on our talkback line.
This is Michelle from IAEA. There needs to be a complete fireworks ban. The only thing that will end this insanity is if fireworks shows are done only by professionals at state-sanctioned sites."
And Natalie writes, "My lifelong experience with fireworks is that they've been organized and set up by professionals. For example, the fire departments, you know, the displays are engaging, exciting, entertaining, and always end with a great finale, which everyone waits for with great anticipation. The same could happen here and would be a great substitute for the illegal fireworks. Since illegal fireworks are continually coming into Hawaii, I support expanding the state's ability to regulate and enforce the law, adding additional inspectors, increasing the budget appropriately, charging a fine and fees for removal and detonation of seized illegal fireworks makes sense in light of this tragedy. Thanks for the feedback. Have thoughts to share about the governor's plan to tackle illegal fireworks? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call our talkback line 808-792-8217.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna with supportive housing, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is a lot of misconduct among academic researchers, even fraud. Can it be stopped?
Identifying the problem is not the same thing as changing our practices.
And how does scientific fraud become big business?
Publishers earn more from publishing more. It's a volume play.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Punahou School, a K-12 community that is dedicated to preparing students for the opportunities and challenges of a changing world. Learn more at punahou.edu.
Chances are you may have a pair of old eyeglasses sitting around your house. Your prescription may have changed, or maybe you wanted to update your frames. Well, those old glasses could be put to good use to help someone else who may not be able to afford a new pair of specs. This weekend, the Lions Club is holding its annual drive to collect those items to send to those in need in other countries. The glasses have ended up in places like Cambodia, Samoa, and Afghanistan. Jennifer Shintani is with the Lions Club committee, Lions in Sight. She joined us in studio earlier this morning to talk about the mission and beginnings of this service club.
In 1925, Helen Keller wanted the Lions to become Knights of the Blind. And ever since then, we've done vision initiatives, everything from vision screening in the schools to collecting eyeglasses and redistributing them to developing countries. The collection has been done ever since then. In Hawaii, we do what's called Lions in Sight, which is an annual statewide drive to do collection of glasses, used eyeglasses, and hearing aids.
And so when did the hearing aids come into the picture?
It was an evolution because, you know, people don't know what to do with their hearing aids. It was a good time to have them just bring in their used hearing aids when we did the glass collection. So as far as the dates, I don't know if we have any specific date that it actually was initiated, but along the way, you know, we'll collect whatever people will bring in.
And so what happens to these hearing aids?
These hearing aids are actually taken for parts, or they're actually sent in for discounts on recalibration of our current equipment.
Gosh, so for someone who is visually impaired or hard of hearing, these devices can be a godsend.
Yes.
In many of these countries, they just don't maybe have the wherewithal and can't afford a pair of new glasses.
Yes.
So, like, where did the most recent drive, where did those glasses end up?
Maybe about 3 to 4 weeks ago, we actually shipped out about 4 pallets to Baguio City Lions Club in the Philippines.
Wow. And so are these then glasses that you collected last year?
Yes, it's been over the, not just last year, but maybe residuals from the prior years.
And so there's a Lions Club over there in the Philippines.
Yes.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yes.
How long have we been sending these glasses to the Philippines?
Well, I've been only doing this for 5 years, and I know it's been sent there previously. Primarily, the Lions Clubs in Kauai used to send them to to Baguio City Lions Club because that's their sister club. And so we just continued our whole statewide drive to be sent there.
Okay. And then, you know, chances are the glasses that people send in, I mean, the frames are perfectly fine. They may just want to update the style, right? If your, let's say, insurance plan covers, you know, regular screenings and your eyes get worse or your prescription changes. But I just know what it's like when you do get a new prescription and you go, wow, I can really see. Things are so much sharper. So that gift of improved sight is tremendous.
Yes.
Is it just limited to glasses, to prescription glasses, or can people donate their old, you know, sunglasses as well?
Yes. Sunglasses, we've been actually distributing to the foreign fishermen that come to port. And, you know, they've really appreciated it since when they go out to sea. You know, it's a good thing as far as for the UV rays and the protection against the glare.
Oh, my gosh. So right here in Honolulu Harbor?
Yes.
That's amazing. And so have we been doing that a long time?
We've been doing it for, I think, over the past 5 years. But it's more recent than the other used eyeglasses.
Okay. So if people have extra sunglasses that they don't need or older prescriptions, they need to get them in the hands of people who can use them.
Yes. They don't need to be prescription glasses. You know, regular sunglasses are fine. I think more than anything, it's easier to distribute non-prescription sunglasses than prescription sunglasses.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, the fact that we send them to developing countries. I mean, you know, why is it that we can't just distribute them here in our local communities?
Yeah, our laws prevent us from distributing within the United States. United States requires us to have an optometrist do a prescription, and then they're able to get their glasses, which is why we actually distribute to developing countries with Lions Club that can receive and distribute those glasses.
Okay, so we've got a lobby here that is pretty strong and is keeping those rules in place. But those glasses can still end up in the hands of people who need them.
Yes.
I don't know. Anything else you want to share just about the history of the Lions Clubs here and how people can join if they are looking for something to do?
Yes. We'd love to have people that are interested in service, because vision is just one of our service focus projects. We do other things that have to do with hunger, that have to do with the environment. And so anybody that sees a lion or even can contact the Lions website, www.hawaiilions.org, can probably find the closest contact Lions Club, or contact past District Governor Cecilia Izuo's name will be there, and then she can help refer people to other Lions Clubs.
Okay, because you've got chapters across the state.
Yes, yes.
All right. And I know recently I was at a e-waste drive, I think, that you folks helped out on. So, yeah, I mean, there are just all kinds of causes that you take up.
We did one 2 weeks ago, I think, at Waikiki Elementary School. So they're done in, like, different places over the island, and it's normally, I've seen it done in school parking lots, so people can easily drop off. I mean, you know, it's made so that people can drive up with their either used clothes, e-waste, old batteries, even food, or used eyeglasses.
Okay, so you're there just to help redistribute
what
people are willing to donate. Okay, I just know that it's a godsend, you know, if you've got old printers or monitors and you don't know what to do with them. And a lot of these are perfectly fine, you know, they work great, and so you can get them into the hands of people who need them.
Yes.
And so what do people need to know then about this weekend? Because this drive is across the state on all islands.
Right. We'll be at all Walmarts in the Vision Center, with the exception of Lihue. That one will, collection will be in the pharmacy in Lihue. But we'll also be at KTA on the Big Island, Hilo, and we'll be at Kahala Mall here. In Lihue, I think we're at Kukui Grove, Longs, and several other spots. But it'll be between 10 to 2, and Lions will be collecting your glasses and used hearing aids.
Okay.
But, you know, it's like something where we're there to meet you, show you how much we appreciate the donation of glasses.
And that was Jennifer Shintani, who is helping with the Lions Club drive this weekend to collect spare prescription and regular glasses, as well as hearing aids. The drive takes place this Saturday at Walmart stores across the state and at select shopping malls. Look for links on our website later today. It's now understood that up to 90% of all the cells in the human body aren't human at all. They're bacteria and fungi that live in us and on us. This collection of microorganisms, known as our microbiomes, are like fingerprints in that no two are exactly alike. A new project seeks to understand the microbiome of the vagina, and it's asking for volunteers. Dr. Corey Miller is an assistant professor of reproductive medicine at the University of Hawaii's John A. Burns School of Medicine. She came to our studios and spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about her new project to explore the vaginal microbiome.
Just to kind of paint the picture, like in Hawaii, women that are a Caucasian or non-Hispanic white descent have a preterm birth rate of about 8%, whereas Native Hawaiians, Filipinos, other Pacific Islanders are 12 to 14%. So almost a 50% increased risk. And, you know, it does beg the question, is this really related to race and ethnicity? Is this related to genetic ancestry? Probably not. Is this more related to our structural environment and how these groups of people enter and experience the world? More likely. So one thing that really interested me was these interesting markers in the microbiome of our health. that seem to be related to health disparities. We know that the gut microbiome seems to be different in people that have chronic health problems, such as diabetes and obesity. And we're now seeing this really distinct signature of the reproductive microbiome, specifically within the vaginal tract, that seems to be more predictive of going into labor early.
Let's also define microbiome. Mm. I think about the communities of bacteria, of fungi, all the microorganisms that aren't quote unquote human cells that are living and coexisting in a particular area.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we think about what microbial communities are living anywhere in our world. In Hawaii, the most common microbial studies are looked at in the ocean and stream water and our flora and fauna. Within the human microbiome, this is a new emerging field because of DNA sequencing technology. So in the past 15, 20 years ago, we would identify bacteria by how well we could grow them. And we have a lot of rate-limiting steps in how we can do that in the lab. So a lot of bacteria just don't want to grow in a culture. And so we just don't know that they're there in our bodies. But interestingly, since the advent of the Human Genome Project and the ability to sequence genomes very rapidly, bacterial genomes are much smaller. And so we can even sequence those entire genomes much more rapidly.
So let's talk about the vaginal microbiome, because it feels like that's not usually mentioned in discussions of the microbiome. And we can maybe start with what are some of the reasons why it's not talked about as much?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we're in a unique, interesting era, hopefully, that maybe we can harness this interest in the microbiome in general. But I think women's health in general is probably put on the back burner a lot because it only... The reproductive tract is unique to one subset of people and maybe not, has definitely not gotten the traditional grant funding or research funding that larger proportions of generalized chronic health conditions have.
So this seems like a great place to introduce the Iona Project. In my head, I'm kind of thinking of it as like 23andMe for your vaginal microbiome.
Yeah.
Is that off course?
No, that's absolutely right. So the Iona Project is a project we're starting here in Hawaii to understand the reproductive tract, the microbes that live primarily within the vagina of women across the islands. And the reason for this is that less than 0.5% of vaginal microbiome studies include Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islanders, and Asian Americans. We know a lot about women on the continent in terms of vaginal microbiome associations with health, but we're just, per usual, a bit underrepresented out here in the Pacific, and we don't want to be left behind. There are a lot of emerging therapeutics and technologies that might be able to help, but are they going to help us and our population and our community? Will we be targeting the right types of microbes? We want to make sure that those therapeutics and targets are applicable to our community. So I was introduced to a collaborator at Rutgers University who had heard about this project in Belgium called the ISALA Project. Sarah Lieber and her group, who's a PhD interested in the vaginal microbiome at the University of Antwerp, kind of created this social media campaign. She calls it a citizen science project, where essentially she just gathered a bunch of people on social media and said, who wants to know, like, about their body? You send us a swab, we will do the sequencing and the analysis, and we'll send you a personalized report of what kind of microbes are in your body at this particular time with a description in layman's terms of what that might mean. Granted, we don't know everything yet, but as you follow along with this citizen science project, you can ask questions like, why does my microbiome seem like it's different? I'm having different symptoms or discharge or whatever at this point in the month. Like, tell me about that. And that's kind of the essence of a citizen science project, is those participants guiding the questions. So yeah, the ISALA parent project has inspired many different sister projects. And so along with this person at Rutgers, Dr. Dominguez Bello, we have joined over 50 sister projects, Peru, Nigeria, Spain, across the world, and really wanted to represent and understand our community's microbiome. And so every one of those sisters' projects is named after the first female physician or first female scientist in that community.
And so this is more along the lines of a community science project rather than a clinical trial.
Correct, yes. Anybody who is over the age of 18 and identifies as female can participate by going to our website and signing up. Once you send your email in, you get a survey, and we essentially ask a lot of different questions about lifestyle, exposure, kind of what you eat, how stressed out you are, how much sleep you get, and your menstrual cycle, things like this. And then once you fill out the survey, we send you a kit. You know, this is all anonymous. The kit comes back to us in the mail. And then once we get a large cohort of swabs, we'll sequence them all together and then individually send back participants' profiles about this is the predominant bacteria that you have, and this is kind of what it's associated with or been known to see, been in the literature.
I read that the original ESALA project in Belgium has sequenced something like 6,000 microbiomes. So what is your goal in terms of recruitment?
Yeah, so there are more people that live in Belgium than Hawaii. We were hoping to start with a subset of 200 females that send their swabs in, and we'll kind of go from there to see if we can get a saturation of information. But yeah, an original ESALA project really took off, really through social media just became very popular.
And that's an interesting facet of this too, because it's almost a social movement. Could you talk a little bit about what this could mean for people or why it seems like more so than other scientific studies, people really come together to learn more about their bodies in this way?
Absolutely. I think that that community aspect is unique and not something we see a lot in science, right? You sign up for a research project and you might never, ever get the results of what you contributed to that body of work. But like some of my mentors who've worked in other indigenous populations across the world, we believe that your microbes belong to you. They are yours and you should know about them. And so I think that's one unique aspect of it. And then, yeah, again, kind of this interaction on social media, you know, we post other people's questions, like, what are you interested in? What are you experiencing? Oh, yeah, I had that too. You know, I tried this birth control and it made me feel that way. And I had these symptoms. And yeah, it again creates a sense of community.
What are some, if you have examples, that in the report people might learn about their microbiomes?
I think the biggest kind of characterization of the vaginal microbiome is whether or not your microbiome is predominantly one type of bacteria or if it's very diverse, meaning there's lots of different species. In the gut, you want a lot of different species doing a lot of different things at once because they all help kind of produce these wonderful short-chain fatty acids that protect the epithelium or the lining of your gut. In the vagina, we actually want the opposite. We want one predominant type of bacteria. And so if we have a lot of different types of bacteria, that actually increases inflammation, risk of contracting sexually transmitted infections, risk of these pregnancy complications that I talked about, and even infertility. And so your report will say something like, your predominant bacteria is lactobacillus X, Y, or Z. This particular lactobacilli has been associated with really healthy health outcomes, or more commonly, maybe you have bacterial infections that you need to be treated a lot for, urinary tract infections, et cetera, or there's a lot of different diverse communities. And we kind of also want to know from people, like, I do have a lot of recurrent urinary tract or vaginal infections, or I don't, and I still have this diverse community. Is there something unique about all those diverse bacteria that are still, for some reason, protective? Going back to the health disparities component, like, for some reason, there are some populations of people that don't get bacterial vaginosis even though they have a diverse vaginal microbiome. And so we kind of want to understand if that's the same here.
Earlier you mentioned new technologies, interventions, innovations coming down the pipeline and how it's important to figure out the diversity of vaginal microbiomes to see which interventions might apply best to which people. So do you have examples of things in mind when you talk about that?
Yeah, nothing on the market at the moment, but the overarching concept is we think about this one particular type of Lactobacillus crispatus that seems to be so protective, especially it's more predominant in white women than it is in any other population. And so a lot of the market has been trying to see how we can get Lactobacillus crispatus predominantly living in all of our vaginas. However, there's plenty of women that have a different type of Lactobacillus inners that is thought to be more of a, quote, bad actor, unstable actor. We don't know all that there is to know about different strains of each of these species in different populations and how they might have evolved in one community versus another. And maybe the stability, meaning there's not a lot of diversity in one population, is good and doesn't necessarily translate to a different population, a different geographic area, different environmental exposure.
And so if people are interested in learning more about the Iona Project or contributing to it, how do they find out more?
So number one, you can follow us on Instagram at the Iona Project. And then our website is www.ionaproject.com. And all over the website are links to sign up, which is just entering your email, and then you'll get a personalized email from our study team to start the process. And anyone over the age of 18 who's physically living in Hawaii of any racial, ethnic background, even on neighbor islands, can participate.
And do you have a sense of timeline of when you're hoping to send out the first swath of reports?
Yeah, so we've started recruiting. We have a handful of people already signed up, and the swabs are in the freezer waiting to get sequenced. So we're hoping spring to early summer we'll be able to send back. And on the website, it will explain, you know, waiting for a saturation of our participants, and you probably expect to get your results in 4 to 6 months.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Corey Miller, a physician who specializes in maternal fetal medicine and high-risk pregnancies, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We will have links to the Iona Project on the conversation page of our website later today.
Live from the Atherton, HPR presents the return of our Mele Hawaii performance series. Performing live at our Honolulu studios are Kilia, Keauho, the Malia Lyman Quartet, and Hi'ikua. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Ocean Center, offering island families and individuals memberships providing year-round access to exhibits and educational programs. Learn more about memberships at mauioceancenter.com/membership.
Poster for a new film describes an ordinary woman in Pakistan. The title of the documentary is In Shackles. It debuts next week at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. The premiere is sponsored by several UH centers and a policy think tank in Islamabad. We recently spoke with the filmmaker, Heather Rifat. He hails from the Middle East and felt compelled to tell this story about forced marriages and the plight of young girls and women.
I was in Pakistan over the summer, and I felt like it was an important story to tell because it sheds light on a 34-year-old Pakistani woman who is going through a string of different issues, societal issues that are connected to broader societal problems. So while she's going through forced marriage and sexual violence, but I've connected these two issues with religious hypocrisy, the impact of family conditioning on children, and also the effects of belonging to a low socioeconomic background and how that is also resulting in, you know, low income wages for these rural women who are also very uneducated. And they're oftentimes leading their households, but they don't have enough money to, you know, feed a family of seven or a family of 10. And oftentimes these are huge families and they're just working tireless hours and they don't have that much financial means to really support themselves and their family. So I've shed light on the different issues for a very different reason. And hopefully when you see the film, there are a lot of nuances and layers in the film that you'll see. But it's not just about women's rights. I wanted to link it with other important societal issues as well that not just the main characters experiencing, but I think the overall Pakistani, the whole society is experiencing.
So tell us your connection to Pakistan.
So I'm actually originally from Pakistan. So I'm a journalist there. I also host my talk show in Pakistan. And right now I'm in Hawaii doing my PhD.
So you then are very familiar with this because, you know, you grew up in that culture, in that country, and you saw it firsthand.
Yes, exactly. And because I'm a journalist, I feel like it was an important thing for me to do by picking up the camera and telling an important story. I've done many print media, digital media, but I also felt like, you know, exploring a different dimension of storytelling was very important for me. That's why I decided to do that. And women's rights, because it's also more aligned with my research as a PhD student, which is back home in Pakistan, doing research on women's rights and also legal mobilization efforts, which is also something that I touch in the documentary, because I identify different legalistic gaps in regards to Child Marriage Restraint Act, which has historically kept the legal age of marriage for girls to 16 years, which further gives families a reason to have their children or girls married before turning 18. So that incentivizes families because the legislation grants them that opportunity. And because it grants them that opportunity, we don't know. It's unknowable whether they're getting married with consent or without consent. And I think that falls in the gamut of forced marriage. So, you know, these are all these layers that I've explored. And because it aligns with my research as a PhD student as well, I felt like, you know, it's an important story to tell.
And so the main character that you focused on, this 34-year-old Muslim woman, Shamim,
yes.
Was she in an arranged marriage, a child marriage as well?
She was married at the age of 18, but it was forced marriage. But I've linked that with the Child Marriage Restraint Act, which is why like 1 in 3 girls in Pakistan are married before turning 18. And we don't know whether that's with consent or without consent. And oftentimes these girls are forced into marriage as well. But it's unknowable. But forced marriage is a problem in Pakistan. And I think we're seeing the ripple effects of it all over the world. It's not just true to Pakistan. Maybe people from different cultures who are watching the film might also be able to relate to it somehow.
And how are you able to get Shamim to talk freely about her situation and how she looks at her predicament there?
So because I also live in a remote area in Islamabad, which is the capital city of Pakistan, Shamim lives in a rural area nearby. And I actually knew her beforehand, which is why she felt comfortable being in front of the camera. And, you know, when I was having that conversation with her over the summer, I was like, she has such a unique, important story that can maybe change the discourse around women's rights. Why not pick up the camera and tell a story? And because I knew her and I had that rapport with her, she felt comfortable in front of the camera. But when you see the film, she covers her face because of obviously reasons of identity, but she felt comfortable telling her story that way.
And what do you hope to do with this film? I mean, it's going to be screened here at the university, but yes. What else would you like to see come out of this?
I think the most important thing for me is to change the way individuals see women in Pakistan. And also, I wanted to shed light on the resilience and the tenacity and the strength of Pakistani women, because despite all these adversities that have come in the way of Shamim's life, she has stood all these challenges head on, taken them head on, and is still standing strong. And that's the message in the end that I've also provided, because we oftentimes don't give Muslim women enough credit for being very resilient leaders of their families. And I think that's something that Shamim is doing as a single mother, raising 2 children, one from her first marriage, one from her second marriage, and also taking care of her sick mother. So she's juggling a lot of stuff. And on top of that, having a unsupportive family member like her brother, who is kind of like not wanting her to pursue education and not even wanting her to do work for her children, because that's her only way of earning a living. So my main goal with this film is to not also identify legalistic gaps, but also to shed light on women's rights and also to bring forth a perspective of resilience and tenacity of a Pakistani woman.
And so if our listeners would like to see the film, what are the particulars? Where do they go and when will this be screened?
So the official screening event is taking place at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in Hamilton Library, room 306 at 1 p.m. on Friday, January 24th. It's a free screening so everybody can attend. There's a QR code as well that I can provide you as well. But apart from that, the same day on January 24th, the film is releasing on YouTube under Heather Rifat Films, which is HeiderRifat Films on YouTube. If you do just do a simple Google search or a YouTube search, you will be able to locate my channel. And that's where it's going to land on January 24th.
And is it your hope that you might be able to get this screened also in Pakistan?
Yes, that's my hope, because this is the premier event is at UH, University of Hawaii at Manoa. So right now I'm planning to do this in Hawaii. And then when I go back, hopefully I go back every summer, so I'll be able to screen this back home as well. So it's an interesting film, and I wanted to make sure like it's very multi-layered and nuanced, and hopefully it sheds light on not just Shamim's story, but also other affiliated issues that I've touched on in the film as well. So I'm very excited.
We've been hearing from filmmaker Heather Rifat. His documentary, In Shackles, premieres a week from Friday at the Hamilton Library. We'll have links on our website later today. You can't talk about the National Tropical Botanical Garden without mentioning the Breadfruit Institute. A few years back, we featured Diane Rangoni, who some regard as the mother of the breadfruit movement. Her connection to the gardens on Maui and Kauai, where the institute was born and nurtured, made it an easy decision to visit the Garden Isle recently. It was there that we met two staffers who tend to the Ulu Forest on a daily basis, battling the wind and rain and an assortment of pests.
My name is Neil Uno, and I am an agroforestry technician here at the National Tropical Botanical Garden.
Tell us, where are we standing?
We're inside of ROBA. It's an acronym. It stands for the Regenerative Organic Breadfruit Agroforest.
So we're in a little mini agroforest here. And so tell us about the varieties that you have planted.
So we have about 27 trees in total, and some of them are the wild relatives of breadfruit from Papua New Guinea, the Philippines, Southeast Asia. That's breadnut. It's a large forest tree, and it has a lot of seeds, as opposed to the Polynesian and the Micronesian breadfruit, which is also in ROBA. And those don't have seeds or have very little seeds because they've been selected over many countless generations to be without seed.
And we may know them as canoe plants because they were, you know, brought over on canoes, and they helped sustain, you know, the navigators as they were out on different ways of preparation to ferment it and to keep it good to eat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dried, fermented. And then the plants themselves, the live plants, were transported from Tahiti to Hawaii. Yeah. So they've been on quite a journey.
So tell us about why it's so important to have the varieties that you have here.
So ROBA was specifically designed to create an agroforest where you could harvest year-round. And also the varieties were selected for their high nutritional value. This actually isn't the full collection of breadfruit that NTBG has. The full collection is on Maui in Kahanu. And we have something like 150 different varieties. And so inside of here, we have, I think, something like 10 or 12. But they represent the core collection. So these are trees that we've distinguished with some of the best nutritional content, or like they can help extend your harvest season.
And then just as far as variety, taste, and texture, I mean, I don't know, can you tell one breadfruit from another?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, and we definitely have our favorites in here. There's one particular from Tahiti that has a red skin. And to me, and I think others will agree, that once it's steamed up and cooked, it tastes just like a buttered potato. The kind of main dividing line is we have what are called the hybrid varieties. And so those are hybrids of Dug Dug and breadfruit. And those come mostly from Micronesia. And so the texture of that fruit, it's a little lighter. It's not as dense as, say, the Polynesian breadfruit. So the ones from Tahiti, Samoa, Hawaii, They're all like a denser fruit.
A bit heavy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's more like potato, and then these are kind of light and effervescent. They'll melt in your stew.
Are there tricks to growing them here? I mean, some like maybe the area that we're at and some not so much.
They require a certain amount of care, but part of the reason the breadfruit orchard was planted was part of a restoration process in heavily used soil. Because this used to be a sugar plantation. And so after a century of kind of heavy agricultural use, we wanted to have this plot of breadfruit trees to kind of look at how they can help reforest areas that have gone through this monocropping process. And they're actually pretty, require a light touch in terms of horticultural expertise and maintenance overall.
And they're not super thirsty plants, are they?
No. They tend to do well with just whatever rain we get. I think one of the main pillars here is food security. And this is a reliable starch that grows on a tree, and it grows really well in Hawaii. And there's lots of different varieties you can choose from to plant in your own backyard and have food for yourself and your whole community.
And then your favorite way of preparing breadfruit?
I like it fried. It's really good fried.
In an air fryer?
Oh, no. It's deep fried. Yes. Chips, tostones, french fries. Yeah.
Yeah, that has my vote, too. UNO's colleague, a tropical crop diversity scientist, Julia Avila, hails from Brazil. There is a gastronomy institute in the South American country that works to ensure that their Brazilian cuisine, which includes ulu, isn't lost. Avila told us that breadfruit has ties to Brazil's slave trade.
The history of breadfruit there is more related to slavery. So it's not as appreciated for people, as for people in Pacifica, let's say like this. But definitely on the northwest of Brazil and in the north of Brazil, you can find it in some farmers' markets and some agroforests is like here.
And so the varieties, can you tell the difference between Brazilian breadfruit and...
Yeah, it's definitely something that we need to understand better. Some genetic studies could be really meaningful to be done. Definitely, I could say that it's way more uncommon to be sold. It's pretty for local family consumption. But here and there, you can find in farmers market. But if you find, it's really uncommon, yeah.
And so what's your favorite way of preparing bread?
I like to go simple, like steam, and eat with different types of complements. It's my favorite. I love potatoes, so everything that I can do, that I can use breadfruit instead of potato, I really prefer.
Okay, so whether it's like fries with ketchup or some other kind of sauce.
Yes. And also mash, like instead of use mashed potato, mashed breadfruit, it's also amazing to me. The curry that you also like, I love it.
And then tell us about the challenges that you might have here in tending to these trees here, like pests, diseases, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So we do have some invasive animals that we definitely deal in the entire Hawaii, but here it's an example of these two, from invasive snails to invasive beetles, as we are having here on the National Tropical Botanical Garden too now, mites. Definitely, we still are not seeing the rhinoceros beetle effects here, but we know they are around. And as organic agroforests, we definitely are doing our best to take care to recognize if they are around, we are seeing first effects to kind of avoid further damages, yeah.
And then what about like mold or disease?
Yeah.
Is that fairly common or are they pretty hardy?
So breadfruit's a pretty resilient plant, but definitely our biggest challenge here during the time that we are here have been more like some floats. Like the breadfruit is a tree that don't like to be sitting on really wet soil. So that is a challenge that we kind of really had to take care of a tree this year, because it, after a flood, was too much water around it for a longer time.
And so we don't like soggy soil. Yes. Not happy.
Yes, exactly. And I really think that it's amazing how much people are looking for local varieties, understand better the local varieties from Hawaii, and to bring different varieties. So many farmers nowadays look to understand and to have ulu, but also complementing it with other varieties from Pacific, that it's so good to have this diversity, that it's not only biological diversity, but also nutritional diversity to the community, to the farmers. So,
do you hold classes here? People want to find out about ulu? Do you sell the ulu plants?
So the majority of, it's all donated. The majority of it go to the Independent Food Bank of Kauai. And we also have some donations that go to staff here from the NETBG staff.
We have been hearing from Julia Avila, tropical crop diversity scientist at the National Tropical Botanical Garden on Kauai. And before that, we heard from Neil Uno, a technician there. And if I recall right, Avila's favorite way to prepare breadfruit was steamed. We hope you've enjoyed learning about ulu as we visited the breadfruit orchard. There are more ulu stories that we are featuring this week as we celebrate the year of our community forests. So stay tuned. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we talk about changing for climate change. What's on the horizon as lawmakers head back into session tomorrow? We encourage you to share your comments or questions. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.